It was about 3 years ago that Alan Sepinwall came out with a book called The Revolution Was Televised. Alan is the television critic for HitFix.com, writes a column called What's Alan Watching? And the book was a look at some of the shows that had fundamentally altered the way TV dramas were both made and viewed. But at the time, two of those shows, Mad Men and Breaking Bad, were still on the air. And so now that they are off the air, he's gone back and revised and updated the book to add in stuff about what those shows meant now that we can see them in hindsight. And he joins me now here on the show. Hi, Alan. How are you?
Paul, thanks again for having me.
It's a pleasure. I really enjoyed reading the updated chapters in this book and the updated epilogue as well. But what did you learn in the 3 years since the original edition?
Well, among other things, I learned that I'm very happy I wrote the book when I did, because even though Mad Men and Breaking Bad weren't over yet, the TV business was in a relatively sort of static state at the time, like it achieved a kind of equilibrium in the wake of all the shows I wrote about in the book. And there's been so much change so quickly in the last 3 years with Netflix and Amazon and everything else that's happened that I like would have been constantly revising the book and tearing my hair out trying to make it seem current if I was doing it today.
The original shows that you wrote about were The Sopranos, Oz, The Wire, Deadwood, The Shield, Lost, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, 24, Battlestar Galactica, Friday Night Lights, and as I mentioned, Mad Men and Breaking Bad. In retrospect, have your thoughts changed about any of those?
I don't know if they've changed so much. I mean, one of the misconceptions when the book first came out was this idea that, like, this was me writing about, here are the 12 greatest dramas of all time, and it's really not that, because lots of other things would be in there. These were sort of my attempts to illustrate the ways that TV changed around the turn of the century. And so 24, you know, that's not, like, one of the, you know, 10 or 15 greatest dramas ever, but it was important in terms of talking about how TV became much more comfortable with serialized storytelling. You know, I don't know that there's any of the shows that I think more or less of over time. I think definitely writing the book gave me a renewed appreciation of The Sopranos, which I had loved at the time, and I felt kind of had maybe fallen behind The Wire and maybe one or two other shows in my estimation until I went back and was rewatching it.
I think one of the things that's fascinating about most of these shows is that we know the names of the people who made them. I mean, there was a time when you knew what a Norman Lear show was. Maybe you knew the Charles brothers who created Cheers and Frasier. Maybe you knew the names of people like Stephen Bochco. But now, with names like David Chase and Matthew Weiner and Vince Gilligan, the showrunners have become celebrities unto themselves, haven't they?
I mean, you know, ABC doesn't even need to put any of the actors from their Thursday shows in ads. They just need to say the name Shonda Rhimes, and people will tune in. It's definitely, things have really transformed in terms of the idea of the celebrity showrunner, and I think that's great. You know, for a long time in the movies, we became obsessed with the director, and in TV, the writer/showrunner is generally equivalent in terms of decision-making, and it's all a collaborative process, but someone starts out with the idea, and it's cool to me that they're getting far more recognized now than they used to be.
Now, about the showrunners, I'm curious about their power, because there was a time when you worked for a big network, ABC, NBC, CBS, Fox, that the network had a lot of say in what you did. But then came The Wire and Sopranos on HBO, and now we've got all these different outlets. But I'm curious about the people who you write about in this book. Did they have more freedom than their predecessors?
Oh, very much so. Very much so. You know, David Chase had started out writing for the Rockford Files. He wrote for Northern Exposure, a bunch of other network shows, and those are very good shows, but they were still being done within, like, real strictures. And when he went to HBO, HBO had never really made dramas before, so they basically said, do whatever you want. And that's what's been going on. Every time a new outfit gets into the game and says, all right, we want to make our own shows, it's like the Wild West, and there's so much freedom because law has not yet arrived to this particular territory. And so you're seeing that right now a lot at the streaming channels like Amazon and Netflix. The creators there, they get some input, but it's basically whatever they want to do, they can do for good and for ill.
And was that the case with Vince Gilligan at Breaking Bad?
Yeah, for the most part. I suspect he would have liked the show to maybe go a little bit longer, or at the very least not have some of the split seasons. But, like, that's the show he wanted to make.
I read in the book about Breaking Bad that Vince Gilligan didn't know where the show was going to go season to season. And Matthew Weiner, the same thing with Mad Men, didn't really have a long-term vision for the show except for maybe getting through the next few episodes. Is that a common thread with these showrunners?
Mostly. I think The Wire, David Simon, the co-creator of that, had specific plans, and he knew, like, this is how I want things to go over the course of the season or over the course of the series. But even there, he improvised. And, like, there's this belief that people say, you know, oh, if they're making it up as they go along, it's somehow invalid. But pretty much all of the things that people love most about Breaking Bad were made up as they went along. So, like, at one point, they decide, all right, we're going to do a flash forward, and Walter White's going to have a machine gun in the trunk of his car, and we will figure out much later on why he has the machine gun and who it's for. And that kind of storytelling worked really well for them for a really long time.
But they lamented the fact that they had done that, because then they thought, oh no, now we got to figure out what to do with that, and that was a problem, wasn't it?
Well, it was a pain for them to do, but I think the end result was really good. And in some of the other chapters, I talk about times where the creators, like, had a very specific plan that wound up becoming more trouble than it was worth. So if you look at something like, I think I mentioned this in the new prologue, How I Met Your Mother, which was a really good show but had a predetermined ending that they would not deviate from no matter what, and ultimately, like, that's an ending that most fans of that show just absolutely hate. But, like, that was their plan, and they stuck to that plan. So sometimes plans can be problematic.
You say in the book that towards the end of the run of Mad Men, you told Matthew Weiner that it had inspired many other shows of its type, but he didn't agree with you, did he?
Yeah, no, he said, I still think it's the only show of its type. And, you know, Matt Weiner, he worked on The Sopranos, and he was aware of all these other shows going on, but, like, he always believed that his show was the best show, and most of the time it was on, it probably was. So, like, you can't blame him for that any more than you can blame a hitter in baseball for thinking, like, I'm the best guy, I'm going to hit every pitcher I go up against. Like, it's just a mentality that I think some people need to have in whatever field they're in order to make it through.
What about some of the other people behind the other shows you write about? Do they see some of the current product as their own descendants?
Some absolutely do, some don't. Like, David Chase is very disinterested in watching any current TV except a couple of shows made by Weiner and Terrence Winter, who wrote for him on Sopranos. But, like, others, they talk all the time. You know, I'm still in communication with, like, Damon Lindelof, who created Lost and is now the co-creator of The Leftovers, and he's constantly raving, you know, about The Americans, about Fargo, about lots of other current series, and really impressed by the current state of TV.
Talking with Alan Sepinwall, his book is called The Revolution Was Televised, How the Sopranos, Mad Men, Breaking Bad, Lost, and Other Groundbreaking Dramas Changed TV Forever. You talked about new distribution channels, and I want to get into that a little bit. I've been a fan of a couple of shows that have come down the Amazon and Netflix pipeline this year. One of them was called Bloodline, and the other one was called The Man in the High Castle, although I admit I'm not 100% certain about the latter. I'm still thinking about it. But in each case, they went on for 10 episodes or so. But in my estimation, they dragged in the middle. And maybe doing 10 episodes was too much, because obviously they had a big, long story laid out. And they did all the shows before they were presented to the public, so they couldn't get any feedback on them. You've watched these things. Do you feel that same drag in the middle sometimes because they're just kind of stretching it?
No, absolutely. I've written pieces for HitFix about that exact problem. You know, it's awesome that Netflix and Amazon and Hulu sort of treat their entire seasons as just that's the storytelling unit as opposed to the episode, and that's the way that The Wire, for instance, worked, or the way that Boardwalk Empire worked. That's very hard to do, and there's a reason that, like, episodes have structure. And I feel like what's happening now is we're just saying, all right, we're just going to give you 10 hours, 13 hours of stuff chronologically, and whether or not there's a satisfying experience within any individual hour, we don't really care about because we're just giving you the story. And as a result, things start to drag, and also a lot of the time, as you say, there's not enough material to fill all 13 of those hours. Bloodline, I think, if they had done 5 or 6, that would have been a much stronger show
yep.
than over 13. Jessica Jones is another Netflix show I liked a lot. That was 8 hours of story in a 13-episode bag, and it suffered as a result of that.
Well, why do these outlets that they don't have the demands of having to fill, you know, a Tuesday night at 9 o'clock slot every week? They don't have to put out 13 or 22 episodes. They could do whatever they want. Why do they force themselves to stretch like that?
I think because everyone's still learning. It's pretty early in the process of the streaming evolution of TV. And, you know, even at HBO, it took them a while to settle on 13 episodes as the number. If you look at some of the pre-Soprano shows like Oz, like Sex and the City, Dream On, Larry Sanders, their season numbers varied a lot. And I think it's like right now people think, all right, we should do 13 because that's what HBO's done, you know, or we should do 10 because that's what a lot of other channels are doing now. And I think that there needs to be a little bit more flexibility, but the problem is then the fewer episodes you do, the less people get paid because often people are paid by episode. So there's a lot of different financial considerations that have to be figured out. I talked to the creator of Transparent on Amazon, which is a great show, and she says basically like she just wants to treat all 10 episodes of the season as one thing and be able to slide pieces from one episode to another. But Hollywood guilds have rules about who can direct and write and be credited for each episode, and if you start doing that, that runs against guild regulation. So there's a lot of, like, just weird technical stuff that no one has quite mastered yet.
Yeah, I don't mind the long-form storytelling. Certainly Breaking Bad and Mad Men and most of these shows, even The West Wing, if you were to go back there, there's long-form storytelling, but there is that self-contained episodic structure. And one of the things that bothers me about shows like The Man in the High Castle on Amazon is when it got to the end of the 10 episodes, nothing was concluded. It wasn't even like there was a cliffhanger of any kind. It was kind of like, okay, that's all you get right now. We'll be back next year when we figure out what those 10 episodes are going to be like. I found it less satisfying that way.
No, that's absolutely an issue, and I would like to see someone solve it. I think some of the streaming shows are better at it than others. What's funny is now you see a lot of cable shows, which are still released weekly, but the creators clearly wish they were making a streaming show, and they're structuring those shows along those lines. Like some of the Showtime series, for instance, really feel that way.
I'd rather have something like the show Fargo, which has aired for two seasons now on FX, but they have been distinct seasons. Each season told its own individual story.
You know, each season told its own individual story, and even within the serialized nature, Fargo is smart enough to say, all right, this hour is going to be about this, and it's going to have a beginning, a middle, and an end within that hour, so you come to the end of the night on Monday, and you're incredibly satisfied.
Would Fargo be on a list of shows for the next update of your book?
Possible. I mean, I think there's definitely a new book to be written, not now. Like, I think you need time to look back. I was writing about shows that, you know, some of which were 15 years old or longer when I started writing the book. I think, like, you know, 5-10 years from now, you could go back and you could write a book that would deal with Fargo and American Horror Story and True Detective in terms of these miniseries anthology idea. You would deal with Game of Thrones and Walking Dead in terms of cable drama and embracing the blockbuster mentality. Louie and Girls and some of these other sort of indie film as TV sitcom approaches, and, you know, absolutely a bunch of the streaming shows. And, like, again, TV is transforming as rapidly in the last 3 years since the book was first published as it had in the 15 years since the events of the book began.
Also, you have to wait and see what next quality series Jesse Plemons will be in.
Yes, and he will be killing. How many people he will be killing in that show? I love that guy. He was in Friday Night Lights. He was in Breaking Bad. Then he was in the season of Fargo. Always good, and yet always with blood on his hands.
Now, while we're talking about the new distribution channels, a friend of mine recommended a show to me the other day, the name of which I've already forgotten, because it's on Crackle. Now, I know that Jerry Seinfeld's Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee is a Crackle thing, but when I want to watch each episode each week of that, I just go to the website for Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee. I've never gone to Crackle. I've never looked it up on my TV, and yet it is another distribution platform. Are we quickly approaching a point where there are so many of these that the TV consumer can't have any idea what's out there?
It's absolutely an issue. You know, we're at the point where I think in the summer FX estimated there were going to be about 400 original sitcoms and dramas on television in prime time across network, cable, and streaming over the course of this year, and that's just too many for anyone to physically watch. You know, even a TV critic like me. You know, I wrote the other day about a show called Manhattan, a drama about the scientist who built the first atomic bomb. It's really good. It airs on cable. You know, but it's on a channel, WGN, that, like, almost nobody watches or looks to for scripted shows. And so the audience is barely there for it, let alone when you start working in new streaming platforms like Crackle and everything else. everyone's trying to get into this game, but there's not enough eyeballs, I think, to probably sustain them all.
Of course, that getting an identity for your channel or your outlet is exactly the problem that AMC had before Mad Men.
Exactly. They were the second place classic movie channel. They were the one, you know, with commercial interruptions and edited language and, you know, why would you watch it? And then suddenly they had Mad Men, and, you know, if they ever tried, if a cable system ever tried to take them off after that, they would get complaints.
I want to talk about one thing that has been a trend through series of the last 10 years, and that is the wife of a bad guy being seen by the audience as the enemy. You know what I'm talking about here.
Oh, yes, the Skyler White problem. That's been a big issue. Skyler, Carmela Soprano, Vic Mackey's wife, a whole bunch of, you know, Betty Draper.
Betty Draper, yeah.
Exactly, where it's like in any sane rendition of the story, they would be the sympathetic and wronged character. But because the show is told from the point of view of the villainous, you know, white guy, the audience is trained to empathize with the protagonist, no matter how awful the protagonist is. And so suddenly, like Anna Gunn, the actress who plays Skyler, is literally seeing death threats. People so hate Skyler that they would like to harm the actress who plays her. Mm. That's not good at all.
How do we change that?
I don't know. I don't know what we do, because I think in certain cases it's tapping into, unfortunately, you know, anti-woman sentiment or other feelings that the audience, certain viewers bring to it. But I would like to think that people will get smarter and get more accustomed to the idea that, oh, hey, I'm watching a show with a bad guy. But even now, like I've seen people say about Breaking Bad, oh, Walt was the hero of that show, which is insane to me.
Well, maybe we need a show with a female anti-hero.
Maybe, although they've done things like that. Homeland is arguably that kind of show, and I think a lot of the audience hates Carrie. So I think like there's a line that male characters can cross and get away with that female characters unfortunately can't.
You and I started talking several years ago because you were writing show recaps of episodes. They would air at night, and in the next couple of hours after that, you would post something about that show in such detail and such analysis, and you continue to do that to this day, these kind of instant critiques. First of all, how do you find enough hours in the day to do that and still have a family? And then secondly, with all the showrunners you've talked to about this, how do they feel about it?
It's a very mixed reaction. You know, David Simon, the creator of The Wire, he hates it. He just thinks, like, you can't, you know, I'm making a novel for television. You can't, like, grade each chapter of a novel. That's stupid. You know, and then there's, you know, David Chase doesn't read a lot of it. But then I think there's others who really enjoy it. Like Vince Gilligan, I remember, you know, having an early conversation about how much he liked seeing what people had to say about his show. So it's a mixed bag. I think for the most part, creators are better off ignoring that stuff. And, like, I'm not writing for them. I'm writing for the viewer of the show. And, you know, I find time because for the most part I get screeners of things, so I've seen them in advance and I've written those reviews in advance. Mad Men was really the last show for a while where I was staying up late on a Sunday night to recap it. But everything else I can sort of do in advance and pick and choose what I'm most interested in writing about.
Were any of these shows still making episodes for that season while you were writing about the earliest episodes in that season? And if so, did anything you wrote kind of affect what happened?
Not necessarily with the shows in the book. I know, like, I've heard occasionally showrunners say, like, I saw you said something, and that made me rethink things, which, again, is not my intention, but, like, you know, it can be sort of cool if a thing I don't like goes away because I've publicly said that.
Yeah. There was a lot of controversy about the end of The Sopranos. What happens to Tony in that coffee shop? Is he dead, or was it just, okay, here's the plug being pulled on the show, and it's done. There was also controversy about the finale of Mad Men with Don Draper and the Coke commercial, I'd Like to Teach the World to Sing. What do you think happened?
Well, to Tony, when I first wrote the book, I was pretty, like, certain that he didn't die. That was my feeling, and a lot of Sopranos fans were really mad about that, you know, because they're convinced he dies, and any other interpretation is idiotic, and I think it was more of an ambiguous thing. Since then, David Chase has made enough comments that have started to point me a little more in the direction that he could have died, but I still think it's ambiguous, you know, and I include some of those in the updated version of the Sopranos chapter. As for Mad Men, I remember watching it that night and thinking, wait, Matt Weiner has specifically told me that he was never going to assign a famous ad campaign from the real world to one of his characters, but he did it there, and, you know, writers change their minds, and, you know, I think it's a very memorable ending. I think it's very true to the spirit of the show, the opening credits and everything else. It does strike me as a little bit cynical, but Don Draper was a cynical character, and if he goes on this cross-country journey of self-discovery and the most he gets out of it is to write a better ad, that's more or less who he was to begin with.
So you think that that's actually what Weiner meant us to believe at the end?
Yes, no, the few public comments he has made it very clear that he meant for Don to write the ad.
Okay, so these are all dramas that we're talking about here. Is there an equivalent change in the paradigm when it comes to sitcoms?
I think to an extent, although you might question the definition of what is and isn't a sitcom. I mentioned Louie before on FX. That's a show where basically one guy does the jobs of about 15 people on any other show. So Louis C.K., he writes every episode, he directs every episode, he stars in them, he edits them, he helps pick the music, everything else. But you've also seen just a lot of these sort of independent, you know, Sundance Film Festival kind of comedies now being done as TV series. So there's Girls, there's Transparent, there's Togetherness, there's a whole bunch of different ones. You know, and I think that's obviously never going to be the dominant form because people like to laugh, and some of these shows are, you know, more overtly amusing than others. But there's been a much more of a push towards doing those kinds of half hours, at least.
I can remember a time when for all of these shows, both sitcoms and dramas, there was enormous ratings pressure. You know, the Big Bang Theory is still the highest rated non-sports show on television. But the shows that we're talking about here, in many cases, had a niche audience. That's also part of the new TV, isn't it?
Yeah, no, that's the TV audience had already started breaking up around the time that, like, The Sopranos debuted, and that's, we're going back to 1999. Now, almost everything is a niche, other than, oddly, The Walking Dead. So AMC went from the second-place movie channel to the channel that has the most popular scripted show on television. The only thing that ever beats it is football. So it's remarkable. So, I mean, it's a good and a bad thing. It's bad because you start to wonder whether there's money to support these shows with these ratings, but it's good because when you're not expecting to get a big rating, you can do something that's a lot more specific, and specific is almost always better, whereas before TV was made to be the least objectionable, most big tent kind of thing, and you've got a lot of generic, interchangeable stuff.
Does The Walking Dead do better than The Big Bang Theory?
Yes, Walking Dead is more is higher rated than Big Bang Theory.
Wow. So what does that lack of ratings pressure do to the creative sorts in Hollywood who always used to think, okay, well, I got to get X number of viewers if I want to keep my show on the air. Is that even relevant anymore to them?
I mean, it's not relevant. So The Leftovers, which I mentioned before, is my favorite current show on TV. And that's a show that's very divisive. It's very sort of specific. You know, a lot of people just find it depressing, and I get that. And in the first season, the ratings were okay, but not great. The second season, which I thought was even better than the first, the ratings plummeted. And even though it's on HBO and HBO doesn't sell ads, to a certain extent, they still care about numbers because, like, if almost no one's watching a show, that means no one is subscribing to HBO for that show. And so there was a very good chance that they weren't going to keep it around. But, like, ultimately, I think they decided it was so good and the buzz for it was so strong that it was important to their brand to keep it. But, like, it's still a business on some level. You know, you can go and you can make the most beautiful and artistic television show possible, and sometimes that can be enough to keep you on the air. But there has to be some way to justify the expenditure.
Okay, so HBO keeps track of numbers. Showtime keeps track of numbers. You, as a TV reporter and critic, can find out what those numbers are and report them to us. But that's not true with these streaming services. Netflix never tells anybody. Amazon never tells anybody. So how do they know if a show is a success or not?
Well, they know. They have internal numbers. Like, Netflix probably can more easily and instantaneously tell you, if they wanted to, who is watching a show, what kind of people are watching it, etc. Because, again, they're tracking everything. They just don't make it public. Mm. And they're under no obligation to make it public. HBO was never under an obligation to release their ratings. They just decided to do so because it seemed like a way to make them seem more legitimate in the 90s, you know, in the early 2000s, when they started having these hits like Sopranos and Sex and the City. And I bet you if you gave their executives truth serum now, they would say they regret having done it. So Netflix doesn't have to do it. The only thing that bothers me is that they won't release numbers, but then they try to brag about the numbers. You can't have it both ways. You can't say, I won't tell you how many people are watching this, but trust me, it's a big hit.
Yeah.
That's just obnoxious, and I don't care, and I don't believe you.
Do you think that information passes along to the showrunners?
No, there have been stories written that say that, like, they keep it from the showrunners as well, which becomes a problem at negotiating time. So, like, for instance, if you're, you know, back in the day, if you were James Gandolfini and your contract was up and to continue being Tony Soprano, you know that The Sopranos is an enormous hit and you could use that as leverage in negotiations with HBO and the studio to extend your contract. If you work on Orange is the New Black, you have no idea how many people are watching Orange is the New Black, and Netflix makes sure that you don't, and therefore you can't really say, like, you can't afford to get rid of me.
Wow. Wow. It is a different era. The book is called The Revolution Was Televised, How the Sopranos, Mad Men, Breaking Bad, Lost, and Other Groundbreaking Dramas Changed TV Forever. Written by the television critic for HitFix.com, Alan Sepinwall. Always great to talk to you, Alan. Thanks for joining me today.
Paul, thank you so much.
I'm Paul Harris. This is the Big 550 KTRS.